Hello, this is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. In our talking about community, I've had the great pleasure to interview many, many people from different viewpoints of community. And last week, when we were talking to Kate Kirion, we got into something that was very interesting and maybe for some of you a little esoteric, like, what does this have to do with our Reiki community? And, you know, this has been a great question for me because ever since I met Ben Haggard and talked to him about permaculture, I've been very intrigued about trying to join the permaculture philosophy and our Reiki practice and community. So I've gone through many, many years of trying to figure out how to do this, and I may have struck a place where this can happen, but in the meantime, I'd like to just talk a little bit about my own history. So for me, permaculture and reading Bill Mollison's book entitled Permaculture something, 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 which is a very thick book, and it's really wonderful. I mean, Bill Mollison is an Australian. He pulls no punches, and if you do go to read this book on my recommendation or at least look at it, please read the foreword. I love the foreword, and I love actually what he writes after the book. And in the meantime, you can thumb through the book and read whatever you want. It's really an amazing book about different perspectives of how to look at life, how to look at nature, how to look at our role as a human species on this planet, and what our responsibilities are, and how we can move back into being responsible and being a part of the natural flow of Reiki, of energy. So then I made a little mistake and put Reiki instead, which actually is really where I'm at. When I read this book, I realized that what I was getting into in my practice was learning about how I, as an individual, could be in touch with my own flow, with my own energy, and not my mother's, not my father's, not what my society wanted me to be, or what I thought my society wanted me to be, but what I really was meant to do here on this, in this lifetime. And I've been on this path now for over 30 years, and what has accompanied me is this passion for joining this little piece of the great universal question, why am I here, to the actual universe. So, you know, therefore, this kind of joining of this philosophy and perspective of permaculture. So Ben has, in the last 30 years since I've known him, gone off and really gone into the depth of what I would call, I guess, it went from permaculture to sustainable and now regenerative work. And hopefully, with all these different terms, Ben will be able to enlighten you and perhaps shed a little light on my path and walking with these two hand in hand, Reiki and what I would call the permaculture philosophy. So I'm thrilled to have Ben here on the program. And Ben, thank you very much for making time for us and for sharing a little bit of what you have been living for the last decade.
Well, thanks, Phyllis. I'm really delighted to be here.
Great. So just for consistency's sake and also because it really is the beginning of our story together, can you tell me how you came to meet Reiki? And yeah.
Well, I met Reiki when I met you.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is here in Santa Fe. I live in Santa Fe still. And you and your partner at the time, Michael, and me and my partner, Pilo, all met up at an event in town and hit it off immediately and became friends shortly thereafter and started doing little projects together. We started working on creating a house where people who were dealing with difficult illnesses could come and, you know, experience a kind of healing environment. My partner went on and became a Reiki master and worked in your office for some years. And so I was always hanging out on the edge of the Reiki community.
Right.
For years and years and years.
And in that time, what did you imagine the Reiki community to be? I mean, in some way, even though you had first degree, it was not, you know, it was part of your life and you put it to good use in your occupation at that point, in your vocation then, which was a landscape designer. Is that true?
Yeah. So I loved being around people who practiced Reiki. I got first degree Reiki because I wanted to be able to offer that when it was needed. And over the years, I've been able to draw on it for friends who were not feeling well. When I was living in community, I used it quite a lot. And Peel and I both used it quite a bit in our landscape practice to support the health of the trees and plants that we were planting. So we started for right from the beginning using Reiki to treat trees, especially trees, large plants, when we put them in because they were in shock.
Uh-huh.
So it was a great way to support their health and the health of everything that we're doing. Beyond that, I had very early on a kind of intuition that what my work in the world was around was to help everyone on the planet learn how to lay hands on the earth. That's what gardening is. I mean, there's a certain amount of mechanical stuff, you know, technical stuff, digging the dirt and adding compost and so on. But the deeper energetic exchange has to do with the literal laying our hands on plants, on animals, on the planet itself, and contributing our energy to its well-being. And we benefit from that, and so does the planet, I believe. And that's kind of my mission in life. This may be one of the first times I've ever said it publicly, but it really is, how do I awaken that desire to lay hands on among everyone? And Reiki is a community that, of course, does that. That's what you guys do.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's great. Thank you very much, Ben. I have to take a moment and just breathe here. And you do this with such dimension. You know, it's so simple and so clear when you're saying this. And then I think about all these Reiki students, and myself included, who send Reiki to the earth, especially when we feel like we feel its pain, which is somewhat of a projection. But the other part is that in the early days, you know, when the earth movement was very strong and very public, you know, we would put little plastic or metal globes in our hands and give the earth Reiki. But there is right now, for me, that just feels too distant. I mean, it's a nice thing to do, and it's a wonderful way to start connecting. But the true connection for me is about changing how I view myself as a human being in connection with the earth. And that feels like a much more complicated proposition, mostly because of my own structure, you know, my own socialization.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand what I'm talking about?
Sure. We are taught, we're taught from infancy, and it's a deep thread in our culture since at least the Enlightenment, and really since well before that, that human beings and nature are separate.
Mm-hmm.
And that nature is therefore something that we have to protect or heal or be respectful of. And in the when we conceptualize it that way, we forget that we're it, right?
Right?
We came up out of it. We're actively involved in it. Nothing that we do is disconnected from it. And either we're destructive or we're contributing, but we're completely connected.
Mm-hmm.
Every body is a community, after all.
Right. Every body. Every human body?
Every human body. Any living body, living tissue, is made up of a community of organisms. You know, and we are ourselves embedded in these webs of communities of organisms.
Mm-hmm.
So we are absolutely part of the living tissue of the planet.
Mm-hmm. So how do we get from sending Reiki from a distance to actually getting our hands in the earth? What I realized was, you know, there's this whole childhood thing about get out of the dirt, you're getting dirty, you know, why are you tracking in all that mud and all that? I mean, I guess it starts from there, our actual individual separation.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's certainly a piece of it. And, you know, not everybody's going to want to do it through getting their hands in the dirt.
Right.
I think what I'm saying is that the when you lay your hands on anything, on the table in front of you, you are laying hands on the earth, right?
It
is one seamless whole. And it is always, I mean, you can look at it sort of through the Buddhist lens. It's coming into being and passing away. But it also very literally is doing that. It's one, you know, the material world is continually in this process of exchange and communication. And where that occurs most actively is in the living world.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that I can breathe moment to moment is something that the plants enable me to do, right?
Right.
So I breathe to the plants, they breathe back to me. I could not breathe. The oxygen that I require and the CO2 that they require, we have to be in constant exchange for everything to stay in balance and stay healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So in what sense is it accurate to say that I and the plants are separate?
Right.
We're totally, totally bound together. The minute they're not there, neither am I.
Mm-hmm. So then how, I mean, people have asked me through this whole series of interviews, well, who is the Reiki community? And that's, I think, a great question right at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
For you, who is the Reiki community?
Boy. Well, I guess that for me, a community is something that is bound together through a common purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what it means. That's what the word means. And so to some extent, the Reiki community I've experienced has mostly been the community of masters that I've met through you over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that those masters are themselves sort of stand-ins for these webs of connected people all over the planet.
Right.
And so the fact that all Reiki students are connected to this idea of Reiki and the energy of Reiki, and all of the students who are connected to the Sui system have that in common, means that across all of these different cultures, all different age groups, all different sort of outlooks on life and, you know, activities and livelihoods and so on, there is something that binds together this potentially large, large group of people on the planet. So that's kind of how I visualize the Reiki community. There are those who are very close into the center, and then there are those who are further out. But all of them are linked together by their commitment to participating and contributing through their connection to this energy of Reiki.
Mm-hmm.
Does that speak to your question?
Yeah, totally. That's beautiful. And so, well, some of the feedback that I've gotten recently is, which is not unusual, is that when I talk about the Reiki community, they want to know, well, is it this community in this room? I mean, is it the people in this room? Is it the people that I know? Is it the people who my master has initiated? Is it the people who I don't know? Is it just this amorphous whole? And, you know, when you think about, you know, people, a lot of people have asked about, you know, why can't there be a student community? And there are, you know, there are in individual places on the planet these groups of people who have gathered together. They realize that there's always this question, like, should we be only for the people who live in the United Kingdom, for instance? Or should we only be for people who practice a certain system? Or should we only be for people who are interested in research in Reiki? Or should we only be for people who are not interested in research? I mean, it's a very interesting question that kind of floats around out there. And I wonder if we aren't searching for an answer that's so close to our noses, so to speak, that we don't see it.
Well, that's certainly how I see it. In other words, it's kind of the wrong question.
Right.
Let me sort of step sideways here and talk about the word system.
Yeah, good idea.
Or the word whole. Because in a way, these are different ways of trying to picture the same basic idea.
Right.
So it's a basic human trait to want to put boundaries around things to try and understand them, right? And to say, okay, this is the whole that I'm thinking about, this is the whole that I'm dealing with, right? Whether the whole is my own body or the group of people who live in my neighborhood or whatever it is. The thing is that the boundaries that we create to be able to think about things are illusions. They're boundaries in our own minds. And so every one of the things that you were describing there, the community of Reiki practitioners in the UK, the community of all Reiki practitioners, the community of students and so on, each of those is a whole that is being constellated in my mind by describing what makes them, what do they have in common,
mm-hmm.
right? And so to, I think the issue is when you put the word only in front of it that you get into trouble. It's like, sure, we can take this very complex living thing that might be very big or very small, and we can talk ourselves into being very confused about it.
Right. Right.
Or we can simply say, you know, the community is a networked alliance of many, many people. And I can sort of look at different cross sections of that alliance different ways.
Uh-huh.
Right? I can look at all of the masters that you have initiated. Right? Uh-huh. That's one little cross section. I can look at, you know, you get my point, right?
Right.
People who were masters and then walked away from it. People who stayed, whatever. It doesn't really matter, right? The truth is that everyone was drawn to it through some inner prompting that said, this is important. And it's the this is important that's important, not how you define how big or small the group is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what about this human sense that people have of belonging, you know, and then they want to belong like to a group of, I don't know where this phrase came from, like-minded individuals. Like, what is that? Is that about the human need for safety or this understanding that we are all one, but we don't really want to be, or I don't know.
Oh, Phyllis, you and I, we share a lot of prejudices.
We do. Okay, so tell me.
Well, this whole thing of like-minded, I don't think like-mindedness makes a community particularly. In fact, a community is not particularly whole or interested insofar as it's like-minded, but insofar as it's diverse-minded, right? You haven't increased your ability to see something more whole in a more complete, round, systemic way by only talking to people who see things exactly the same way that you do. So I used to read a lot about this concept of community, and some people say, you know, that this like-minded thing is what's called a lifestyle enclave, right?
Uh-huh.
We all believe more or less the same thing. We all behave more or less the same way. We all like to live in the same, you know, part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lifestyle enclave. It's not a true community. Which begs then the question, well, what is it that we really have in common that causes us to come together across our differences, not because of our likenesses?
Right.
And that's where stuff gets really interesting and gets really creative, right? There's much more creativity in the mix when you have real strong difference.
Well, I get that, but... why don't other people?
Probably
not a good question, but I'd love to hear your response.
Well, I guess the way I see it, because I can see both sides in myself, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. I feel more comfortable, I feel less challenged when I'm among people who basically get me,
mm-hmm.
right? And yet that becomes a little too comfortable, a little bit too stifling after a while, because I'm not being challenged to develop my own, either my own thinking or my own state of being, my own soul, mm-hmm. if I'm only around people just like me.
Right.
And so as uncomfortable it is as it is, I found that my life has forced me or thrust me into environments and situations that are where I'm among people who are really not like me, and then having to discover what allows us to work together or communicate.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't condemn the desire to be in a lifestyle enclave, although I think it can get pretty bizarre. Gated communities and so on. Red line districts in, you know, suburbs and all the rest of it. You know, only people who look and behave a certain way are allowed to live here.
Right.
I mean, that's the extreme manifestation of it. And yet at the same time, I think what keeps us vibrant and healthy as human beings is the continual learning and development that we're doing that can only happen by coming up against what's new, what's different, what's unexpected, what we never even realized we weren't aware of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, in my case, I find that it has pushed me into... enlarging my understanding of who I am, but also enlarging my understanding of and my compassion for the different viewpoints. So I lately have been operating a lot with the image of the circle and making sure in my life that in my life there are representatives of different pieces of the circle. So I have, for instance, a long time ago, I always have needed to have a close friend who does not have Reiki, mm-hmm. who has not been initiated. And I like the more the better, but usually there are three or four people. And I really treasure these people. And when they ask about Reiki, I don't talk to them about Reiki much because...
Well, I don't know if you remember this, but... It took me years to get around to doing first degree, and you got mad at me when I finally did it.
I know. It was like, oh, no, now I have to go find another friend who doesn't have Reiki. But that's my kind of childish reaction. But it's been very interesting for me to always have these people on the outside because I get so involved in Reiki, of course, because you know, that's kind of all I do, that it just makes me feel like a monoculture, you know, in my own house, and that just feels so strange for me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I like the idea or the perspective of, you know, having, seeing my life as a circle and having all these different perspectives represented in the circle, allowing me to become a more whole person rather than just strengthening those things which I like about myself and kind of ignoring or not nourishing those parts of myself that might actually be a gift but are things that I'm scared of or I don't like, and other people represent those places. I don't know if we're getting too psychological here.
Well, there's another way of looking at the same thought.
Yeah,
which is, it's not just about making myself whole,
uh-huh.
Right? Although that is, you know, certainly a valid and good thing to do. But when I am in that circle, you know, let's say uh-huh. it's a community that I'm working with in Mexico City, right? When I'm in that circle, then the collective capacity for insight and the collective capacity for creative breakthrough is much greater than when I am not in it,
mm-hmm.
right? There's a collective mind or a collective thinking process that depends on, you know, having members of the circle who are capable of being awake when, you know, all of the like-minded people are falling asleep.
Right.
And by sleep, I don't mean nodding off. I mean just going into habitual ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's true at whatever scale, whether it's like, you know, checking out my ideas with my friends, all the way up to working with an entire community around, you know, who are we really?
Right.
And where are we really headed?
Right.
How do I set aside my prejudices, and how do I set aside my own limitations to be able to see something I've never seen before?
Right. Right.
And that requires, you know, having lots and lots of perspectives in the conversation.
Mm-hmm. 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 Neat. Well, maybe this is a great segue to asking you or asking you to describe what you're doing these days. it's so far out on the edge of my understanding. Actually, I get the essence of it, but I don't get the reality of it. And it just feels very inspirational and also, taking my question that I began with, which is the partnership of Reiki and my first foray into your world, which was reading Bill Mollison's book, and taking that to a whole nother level of understanding. So what do you do these days, Ben? With communities, which is what you're working with, I understand.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me tell this a little bit as a story.
Okay.
So, as you've mentioned, I got very interested and very involved in permaculture, which is it's a way of helping human beings understand complex natural systems, ecosystems, and helping them to design the way we live, what we build, you know, the landscapes that we live in, and so on. Helping people design that so that they're harmonious with ecosystems.
Uh-huh.
Right? So that instead of creating situations that are actually destructive to a living planet, we're creating things that contribute to a living planet.
Mm-hmm.
So I got very excited about that, as you know, back in the 80s, and worked on it for many years. And what I found is that as I got more sophisticated and as the designs that I was doing got more sophisticated, the clients that I was doing it for, and the client could be anything from, you know, someone who had a home or a farm to a campus or a college or a monastery or, you know, lots of different kinds of clients. What I found is that the clients or the client systems were not able to understand what it was that we were giving them. Right?
Right. Totally.
Because they're alive, right? And most people are accustomed to thinking of landscape as something like a pretty picture, right?
That's true. Mm-hmm.
And that's largely what landscape architecture works on, is how do we create something that creates a pretty picture and that is pretty manageable and uniform. And we were going off in totally the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. So I realized after some years of this that what I was doing was I was looking at the wrong thing. I was working on the wrong thing. It was very satisfying to work with plants and living systems. But the most important living system was people and communities. If I was going to shift, if I was going to have any influence on the way we live here on Earth, I needed to figure out a way to awaken in people the same kind of desire, interest, and understanding about living systems that I experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that this was not a simple education process, right? It wasn't about telling people about it, but I had to actually help them connect it to their own lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so about 15 years ago, a group of us formed a company called Regenesis. And that's what we set out to do, was figure out how to take these fairly esoteric principles of design of living systems and make it relevant directly to the way people were thinking about their lives, their businesses, their organizations, and their communities. And that's what we spent 15 years working on. So that kind of brings me up to today.
Great. So can you give us an example?
Okay. I don't know if this is an ideal example or not, but I'll talk about some of the work that I've been doing in Mexico City in the last few years because it really interests me. And because Mexico City is so complicated, so big, and so polluted, and so, you know, interestingly impossible.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
You know what I mean, yes?
Well, I think all of us are familiar with the long-term pollution problems, the long-term overpopulation, if we could call it that.
Yeah.
It just means that a really amazing amount of people live in a certain space.
Yeah.
And now there's a lot of, I assume or can hear, a lot of violence that has overlaid that and a lot of conflicting kinds of lifestyles that have, you know, been into Mexico. And still, from my friends who live in Mexico, I hear that the young people are still moving to Mexico City, which is just amazing.
Yeah. Well, it's because Mexico City is an incredibly vibrant city. It's like one of the most European cities in all of, you know, the Americas.
Right.
It's just very, it's a dazzling, impossible, crazy place. So we were invited down there. I'm part of a team. And we were invited down there to try and get people interested in Mexico in this question of regenerative development, which is what we work on. And you wanted me to talk a little bit about regenerative and degenerative, and we can come back to that.
Okay.
But so it was a really interesting problem. How would you regenerate Mexico City?
Like,
how would you turn it into a force for the healing of the planet, for making a better life for all living things on the planet rather than something that's kind of constantly going down the drain.
Right.
And so we started out primarily with students and faculty and graduates from a fairly prestigious small university there in Mexico City. Most of these were people who were working in architecture and urban design.
Mm-hmm.
Some landscape architecture, a few environmentalists, and so on. And we sort of stepped back and said, okay, where are we on the planet? You know, how big is the space that this city actually inhabits? And what is its character? And what we quickly discovered is that it's a basin, It's what's called a captive basin, which means instead of having rivers that flow to the oceans, all the rivers flow to the center.
Oh, interesting.
The big bowl, right? And it's a big bowl located at this really fascinating juncture on the continent where the mountain ranges that move north and south, the Sierras, right, meet a mountain range, basically, or a series of mountains that move from east to west, which are all of the big volcanoes around which Mexico City is built. And so it's an extremely rare junction between this north, south, east, west.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of the point, it's a hinge, if you will. And so we looked at all of that, and we looked at how the, prior to the Aztecs and the Aztecs, how they kind of settled it and lived in it, and talked about how its unique ecosystem evolved and how people evolved with it and so on, right?
Uh-huh.
I can't go into the details, it would take all day, but
right.
What we began to realize is that, first of all, Mexico City, it wasn't possible to develop Mexico City until they took this kind of swampy lake river system and drained it out of Mexico City, right? So they took the water and they actually started to drain it out of the city. And they're still doing that. Huge volumes of water are being drained out of the city, right? This is, ironically, a city that's having a severe water crisis.
Interesting.
Right? Very interesting. So it's a city, in other words, that has more water than it knows what to do with. And it's starving for water. So it's actually very, very characteristic. Right, of the kinds of problems that we create for ourselves. We create an engineering solution, right?
Uh-huh.
It creates a much bigger problem than the one that we were trying to solve originally.
Uh-huh.
The other thing that we observe is this is one of the most delicious climates on the planet. It's high up in the mountains, but it's kind of tropical. It is tropical. And so you have the best of all worlds. It's not very hot. Right? Gets plenty of rainfall. It's this incredibly mild, temperate climate, and it has a lot of variation from the bottom of the valley to the top of the mountains in this bowl, which means you can grow almost anything there. This could be one of the most productive agricultural systems anywhere.
Wow.
Right now, today. I mean, if people were simply using all of the available space and growing food, they could produce more than they needed right there in the city.
Wow, that's amazing.
And then we added one other piece of it. And these are all, you know, so on the one hand, you've got a problem around water. On the second, you've got a problem around food that's totally solvable. And then the third, one of the biggest problems they deal with there is transportation and traffic.
Right, right. And I've been in the traffic.
Yeah, well, the problem is that all of the poor workers live on one side of the city, and all of the wealthy people and the big companies where they go to work lives on the other side of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so every day you have umpteen million people moving from one side of the city to the other and then back again.
Mm-hmm.
So looked at conceptually, it's fairly easy. Create employment opportunities where people live.
Right.
So you kind of get the sort of thinking we're looking at. It's like, okay, instead of defining Mexico City as a problem, let's define it as an almost unlimited opportunity for doing amazing stuff.
Uh-huh.
You've got incredible youthful vitality there. It's a very youthful city. You've got this ability to flash communications out. It's a city that where things, fads catch on and flash through the entire city in no time. So you have enormous communications potential. You have enormous labor opportunities and the ability to be productive.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this incredible climate and abundant water, right? So we said, okay, there's your raw materials. Begin to imagine designing a different city. And people, and what we're starting to look at is in this great big system called Mexico City, where are some of the leverage points? Where are places where a little bit of effort and work, given the fact that we're able to flash things out through the community so effectively, could make a huge difference?
Mm-hmm.
And so a number of teams took off on that, and they're now doing these amazing projects about bringing the rivers back, restoring the rivers through the city, and getting people excited about a more pedestrian-oriented city and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of the key to doing the work is helping people see what really is it that we're looking at? What is its essence, right? Not what is the long laundry list of problems or even the long laundry list of historical events, but what is the what's the true character of this city or of this place or of this community, right? And given that character, what is its true potential? What could it truly be? Beyond what we're currently doing or can even imagine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if that's what it could be, if that's who it is, and if that's what it could be, where are some simple things that we could go to work on to transform it?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basic way it works.
Well, so you've been meeting with this group from this university, and now after a number of years, they're going out and starting to do this sort of design by design?
Yeah. Yeah, what they're doing is they're using their increased scope of understanding around what Mexico City really is and how it really works. And they're using it to identify opportunities to make a big difference, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I mean by leverage. They're able to see things they didn't see. I mean, people were running around trying to fix problems all the time, right? And if you fix, if you run around fixing problems all the time, one, your reality is being defined by problems.
Right.
And it's an endless drain of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a little bit, I think Reiki operates the same way, right? You're not there to fix the problem, right? You're there to actually work on the energy system itself, right? How do you support the essence of this person?
Yes, in theory, that's true.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same thing. I mean, Mexico City has an energy body, right?
Uh-huh.
It has places where a little bit of energy, like an acupuncture needle, a little bit of energy inserted here could transform the whole system.
Hmm. Wow.
But in order to do that, we have to understand the whole system. We can't understand the bits and pieces, the problems, the crises, the political instability or the intransigence of the power broker, all of that stuff that people
mm-hmm.
constantly bitching about. Here in the U.S., everywhere in the world, you know, you can't start from there. You have to actually look at what is the, what truly are we seeing
mm-hmm.
as an energy phenomenon, as an energy system, and how do we go to work on it?
Hmm. Gosh, this
so
image.
I'd love to turn the table.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I would love to turn the tables and ask you to apply what I'm saying to what you see with regard to your community, the Reiki community.
Well, I'm speechless. I guess for me, I go to my own, well, so I'm stuttering. So what happened for me on a personal level, is that about 7 or 8 years ago, I started to want to do something with second-degree students. And I started this program called the Second Degree Immersions, which I wanted people to be able to actually have more relationship with the earth as a living entity. So we went out to places that I felt the energy of the planet was not so hidden, I would say, and not so covered over. And we were able to just, even when we did Reiki on ourselves, when we exchanged treatments, even though it was kind of a crude setup and wasn't very comfortable sometimes. The energy of the treatments and the energy of our collective experience as a little group or a little community of Reiki students was really strong, and it was affected by our communication with natural entities in our immediate vicinity. But I was thinking, when you asked that question, if I had done my research, because, for instance, one of the first place we went to was on the edge of the, I have just totally lost track of this name of this place. It's a huge canyon system in Mexico, in northern Mexico.
Oh, yeah, the Copper Canyon.
The Copper Canyon.
So we were on, The Barrancas del Cuore.
Yeah. And we went there, and we were, like, right on the edge. It wasn't that we could walk over a few hundred yards and, you know, look down into the canyon. But we were, you know, in that environment and in a very local community. And the place that we were staying had no electricity and no running water in the rooms. And it was a very interesting place to be. And I really loved it. It was a great place. And it still is a great place, actually. And this particular experiment, I would call it an experiment on my part, led me to doing this, to going to the volcano in a national park on the island of Hawaii, the Big Island, and doing the same program there, and, you know, wanting to find these places on the planet where, as I said, nature is just more alive and present. But if I had done my research about how this, you know, came to be and what all the different factors were that were involved, I could just see that it would have enriched this experience for the Reiki students, and they would have gone home maybe and being able to do their own research about the place where they live and have this understanding, this greater understanding of, you know, where we live on the planet itself. And that, I think, is something that would benefit not only our practice, but benefit our understanding of our placement, as I see it, our placement in the natural environment in which we live.
Mm-hmm.
But it also brings up this incredible opportunity for creativity when you approach things in that way.
Yeah. Well, every place on the planet is unique.
Uh-huh.
And each of us is drawn to a particular place because there's some kind of match.
Mm-hmm.
Between that particular place and us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as a kind of wake-up, you were taking students out into these very powerful and remarkable places. But actually, you know, my little neighborhood on the edge of Santa Fe is a powerful and remarkable place. It's just kind of subtle.
Right.
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 And so I have to observe more deeply and carefully, and I have to do, as you said, I have to do my research to really understand where I am, to understand what it needs to be healthy and how I need to be healthy along with it.
Uh-huh.
Since we are the same body.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. My body is literally fed by this place all day, every day.
Right.
I'm bringing it in and exhaling it out again.
Right.
It's almost a part of us, a part of our awareness that we've allowed to fall asleep. The fact that our experience is continuously being shaped by the places we're in.
Right.
And that actually is a huge part of what, as we're doing Reiki or as we're doing anything, a huge part of what's going on is this substrate experience of being embedded in a particular place.
Uh-huh.
And so bringing that to awareness allows me to engage in what I do in a way that is increasingly harmonious with that place.
Right.
This.
Yeah. So I think that it would be really good for us to go back to this place that you were talking that you were describing earlier about degenerative, generative, and regenerative as ways that we, in our own environment, where we are right now, can start shifting our own perspective and then our own actions.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I'm going to answer that question in a couple of different ways.
Okay.
Degenerative, generative, and regenerative investments is a framework that comes out of permaculture. And the idea is that every investment I make, whether it's in money or time or effort or material resources, that investment is either contributing to something that will immediately start to fall apart and create damage around it. And a good example of a degenerative investment is a house. Right? The minute it's built, or a car is a really good example, right? The minute you drive it off the lot, its value, its book value drops.
Uh-huh.
Because you've spent all of this money on something that is only going to run down. And often a degenerative investment not only runs itself down, but it runs things down around it.
Right.
A generative investment, and again, this is the permaculture perspective, a generative investment is an investment that enables you to grow something that's regenerative. So knowledge is a really useful generative investment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So learning a basic skill, developing a library, sharing your experience with others is a generative investment because then those others, right, or the knowledge I base, becomes the basis for me to create new things, right?
Mm-hmm.
A regenerative investment is one that is inherently self-starting, right? That can grow itself. So planting a forest is an example of a regenerative investment, right? That the forest, once it gets established, has the ability to regenerate itself, has the ability to bring streams and rivers back, has the ability to restore habitat for animals, and so on, right?
Right.
So the only truly regenerative processes are living processes, right? So basically, the vast majority of our human investments are degenerative, and we can see it in the planet as a whole. The planet is being run down by us taking resources and putting them in places that don't support life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. From the perspective of Regenesis, this was kind of our starting point more than 15 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Right? From the perspective of Regenesis, though, we've moved far beyond that way of defining it. And now what we're looking at is that what enables regeneration to occur is to see a new possibility or potentiality that we had not seen before. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So regeneration lifts us out of what exists, because everything that exists is in the process of running down.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Into what could be brought into existence.
Gosh, could you say that again?
Yeah. Regeneration has to do with moving out of the world of existence and into the world of potential. What could be brought into existence.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually requires a shift in mental state, right? It's basically a shift of moving out of problem solving and into seeing and pursuing potential. So if I look, for example, at the Reiki community has spent a lot of time, like every community, spends a lot of time trying to solve problems, right?
Right.
How do we deal with this group and that group and, put boundaries around X and, on and on and on and on, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think like every community on the planet, the Reiki community has all kinds of potential that it has never even realized.
Right.
It could be a force for good and for more life on this planet, far beyond anything it's been able to tap into today. Right. And in order to discover what that potential is, requires putting attention on potential. And one of the things that's really interesting about that is that when you put your attention on what's the potential in the situation, which problems you try to solve and how you go about trying to solve them shifts really dramatically. If your eye is really on what wants to be brought into existence, you know, it really, the priorities around what needs to be fixed shift dramatically. And you know this, you're always looking sort of out beyond the horizon.
Right, but I think that this takes that yearning of mine of looking beyond the horizon to a whole nother level, which I would love to talk about, and I'm just realizing that you caught me off guard with your last question about how does this apply to the Reiki community, and I'm still mulling this over. And I'm hoping that it might be possible for us to come back to this and address this in another hour, because our hour is just about finished, which is a drag. And what I also want to say is that at some point in the last few weeks in your our connection, you identified two definitions of healing, which I also connect with what you're saying right now. And one of them is the healing that I feel like I'm really into and have been into for the last 30 years in my practice of Reiki, which is fixing something that seems to be broken. And I want to underline the word seems, because quite often what we think is broken isn't really, and we learn that through our practice of Reiki. But that is a really interesting mentality. And then the other part, which is underneath that, which I feel like we all get in some way, but we don't know really how to act through that, is healing is to make whole, is to allow everything to become more and more whole, and that there is no, we can't just look at a human being and say, okay, you're whole, now there's nothing else to do. I don't feel like it's not about that. It's about allowing us to fill our potential, and that's what you're speaking of, is filling potential. And it's just very exciting. The big question is, of course, how do we get from one perspective of healing or one perspective of our practice in Reiki to another perspective? And that, I feel like, is a very exciting, has a lot of different answers, and is very exciting for me.
For me too.
Yeah, great. So, Ben, I'm just wondering if in the next week or so, we might have another, I'm putting you a little bit on the spot. But
oh, put me on the spot. I would love to talk with you more.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. And it'd be wonderful for everyone, I think, who's listening. So we're going to end this this program right now. And Ben, thank you so much for all that you've said. I need to listen to this program again for myself. And we'll make another appointment and have another talk.
Great. Thank
Great.
You, Phyllis.
Thanks, Ben, for sharing who you are. It's wonderful. And I just really am amazed at your group, the Regenesis group, and how much you've dedicated, you know, your own potential to the healing of the planet. And I feel so touched by that. And I I hope that someday I'll be able to express that to the whole of your group, you know, and I express that to you to take back into your community.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, listeners, stay tuned for part two of Ben Haggard. And it's a kind of different kind of homework this week, and that is to look around your local community, start finding out, you know, how your community got started and how the earth was formed and what the natural history is and so on, and see if that allows you to be more in touch with where you are and to provide a space for yourself to be a part of that. And we'll be back next week. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.